Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit podcast. Joining us today is Toby Baxendale. He's an entrepreneur and investor, and he was the largest fresh fish producer and distributor to the food service sector. And he sold his business in 2010. And he said on 24th of June last year was one of the greatest days of his life. So why was that, Toby?
Well, Tim, first of all, thank you very much for having me on your podcast. It was one of the greatest days of my life. I mean, other than having a family and getting married and so on and so forth, one of my greatest political day of my life. Because I felt at that moment in time that this country could actually liberate itself from being involved in the European Union and take a world view and be much more global about its outlook and embark upon a free trade agenda. Which is something I'm very passionate about.
So, what are your major gripes then with the EU and the way it's run?
As an organisation, it's unfortunately corrupt. It's never had a firm, certainly in two decades I've been watching it. It's never had its accounts being able to be audited. So that should be a red flag, really, to anyone. When you're looking at the integrity of the institution. Now, I'm not necessarily saying there's criminal activities going on. There may or there may not be, but the point is you can't establish that. It's probably more mess up, cock up theory than conspiracy theory going on there. But it's just a big burdensome bureaucratic nonsense that we don't really need. We didn't have it for multiple millennia in our country's existence. We've had it for the last 43 years, and I don't really see it as a value add to us.
Do you not find that it provides a kind of cohesive glue to the continent as a whole, keeps us together and united?
What keeps us together and united more so than anything is common character and values. That's the glue that binds all people together, not necessarily whether you have a state construct, issuing out decrees left, right and centre. It's the heart and soul and spirit and your intellectual commitment to certain values. That's what binds you together. And also, on a practical level, If Joe is trading with Jorge, who's trading with Felipe, that's the best way to break down any barriers whatsoever when you're, fully interacting with any each and every one of you on a trading basis.
I'm quite curious on, I know that this far you've been arguing a lot on sort of an economic level, and I can see that there's an argument to be made there. But do you not also think that there's sort of an emotional argument for, especially for young people who have a sense of community and belonging with the EU and with people from the EU that have immigrated to the UK, and that as a result of Brexit, a lot of these things stand to be sort of torn apart, for example, as with people in a family unit where one parent is European but they might not have indefinite leave to remain or might not be able to apply for it, considering all the bureaucratic hurdles that are being put in people's place right now. So do you not think that on a social level this might have some negative consequences?
Well, I think it's had negative consequences already for the reasons that you outline. And I mean, one thing I do know, though, that people in the Leave camp and the people who have had the initiative behind the Great Appeal Bill are very, very much intend to say that at the point of Brexit, any one of our European citizens who happen to be here at that time lawfully should be automatically extended the rights of British citizenship. Full stop, end of story. After that is a bit of a different ball game, and would expect reciprocity with our continental partners. But again, unfortunately you do have the politicians in the way there, who wish to seem to play you know, politics with human beings, which is a tragedy, really. And you know, one very brave and bold thing that we could do from a United Kingdom perspective is just act unilaterally on that front, and you know, force our European partners' hands, as opposed to, you know, dancing around the handbags, you know, posturing, which is what's happening now. But I hope that will soon come to an end. But I certainly know from the Leave campaign. I mean, I remember speaking to Bill Cash shortly after. He was one of the, you know, primary authors of what is going to become known as the Great Repeal Bill. And he was, you know, he's strongly pushing for the case of incorporation of all EU law on day one of our exit into UK law, that be very much something done for the citizens. So I think I believe you will see that happen, or something similar to that. So I don't think any non-British national from the EU has any real thing to worry, but I can understand and fully empathise with any unease that someone has in that position, because the politicians are not giving clear direction and guidance, which is what they should be doing. The leadership there is weak.
So do you feel that, or do you advocate that EU citizens' rights should be just guaranteed as of today, the ones that are staying in Britain?
Myself, yeah, unilaterally. I think we'd take the moral high ground. Well, A, would do the right thing, and B, would take the moral high ground, and C, would force the hand of our European partners to do the same with the million or so Brits, you know, who reside in the European Union.
So just on the score of this kind of social cohesion argument and things that you've talked about there, how do you feel around UKIP, who played a large part in the sort of a pro-leave agenda leading up to the referendum? Do you feel they've been a help or a hindrance in where you want to take this country forward?
Well, they've been a help in terms of getting an element of the vote out to vote for leave. As you know, there's multiple reasons why people want to leave, and some of them have no commonality with them at all, just as there's a whole variety of reasons why people want to remain. So they played their role. They weren't part of the official Leave campaign, as you're well aware. I align myself with the official Leave campaign, but they played their role. It's unfortunate and tragic that they have played a role in stirring up some xenophobic sort of views, which don't really have any place in a modern society. But hopefully, you know, we can move away and beyond that now.
In terms of where we are right now, the trade deal doesn't seem to be top of the European Union's agenda, whereas it's very much at the top of a British agenda. Do you think we're in difficult waters at the moment then?
Well, we're in difficult waters. Yeah, you could say difficult waters. I mean, it's what you tend to observe in these situations is the politicians on both sides. Unfortunately, there are sides, and it does take an adversarial approach. That seems to be the nature of politics. But when the negotiators, though, and the people who actually have to work at the coalface, you know, they all realise very much so that it's completely in everyone's interest, both everyone on the continent and everyone in the United Kingdom, to embark upon mutually beneficial trade agreements. So as soon as you can get the emotion and the politics, as soon as you can discharge that and get that out of the way, you can really crack on and do good and do, yeah, as I said, mutually beneficial trade agreements.
You mentioned that you think the economic interests will sort of dominate and then drag the agreement in favour of an open trade agreement that's in favour of the UK. But I'm wondering whether you think it's actually realistic that the politics can even sort of be put aside in this process, because it is in the end politicians negotiating rather than people representative of any of the industries. And I think especially within the EU, they're at the moment motivated by trying to keep the rest of the EU together. So giving the UK an amazing trade deal isn't going to work in favour of that.
Well, Jen, I hear what you're saying. You ask very good questions again, but the problem is, no matter what posturing between either party can be done, you know, they're a member of the European Union, just as we are. In fact, you know, virtually every country in the world is a member of the World Trade Organization, and you have the most favoured nation principle, which means that, you know, you can't do a deal with one party that you wouldn't deal with another party. So, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And we can't be discriminated against by the European Union. Much as their politicians, you know, shout out this argument that we must be punished or there must be a least favourable deal, that flies in the face of all the international agreements that are made, you know, have been made since 1994 in the World Trade Organization. So I think they can't do that. You know, they've recently done a free trade deal with Singapore. You know, the terms and conditions that are applicable to that will be applicable to us. Otherwise, they'd be in breach of their World Trade Organization agreements that they've signed up to. So, yeah, again, I think when the puff and the hot air and the he says she says all dies down, you get down to the brass tacks of doing the functional stuff. This is what will happen, and we will get a very sensible free trade deal, not least because it's overwhelmingly in the interests of the European Union, who trade more with us than we do with them. So I think reason at the end of the day, I have a great belief that will prevail.
From what you've said this far, it sounds like you're quite sceptical of politicians and a lot more in favour of economics and industry and things like that, which I'm assuming comes from your own entrepreneurial background. So I'm curious how you see industry represented in the negotiations. How do you see those two factors interacting?
Well, industry, you've got to be a little bit careful here. I stand firmly, full squarely against crony capitalism. So what you can find, and I'm not suggesting, you know, we've got this now, but we've got to be very wary of that, is that industry or producer groups get together to try and carve out special interests for themselves, and that invariably works against, you know, you and me as the common citizen. So that's bad news. But if you know, the BMW wish to lobby the German government and say, hey, German government and your EU partners, don't be stupid. You know, we need the British car market. It's one of our biggest car markets. We don't want punishment tariffs because we want to sell our cars there to the British consumer. And that keeps jobs going in Hamburg and Frankfurt and, you know, all over the place. In fact, in British plants as well, because they own elements of British plants. So there's a difference. And I'm all for industry. I'm all for businesses, and I'm all for agricultural interests, whatever, shouting, you know, as hard as they can for the interests of just being carrying on trading in a sensible, free and open way. But we've just got to be a little bit careful that there can be no capture of any of the agenda by any parties. So, pro business and entrepreneurship, yes, but, you know, To the point where it goes crony, no.
And you don't think there is going to be a problem with border, with trade from a border perspective, do you? You believe that frictionless borders can be a way forward in this, I guess, as we develop as a society outside of the European Union?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the largest example would be the border between Canada and the United States of America, where nearly 2 billion dollars of trade every single day is conducted. And there's, you know, they have trusted partner status for a lot of the, you know, regular exporters, importers across the border. A lot of things are done electronically with trusted partners who customs officials know will be playing the game correctly, not scamming on documents and trying to get out of customs and duty fees. So this is all well tried and tested. The Norwegian Swedish border works on that basis as well, and I suspect we will adopt very, very similar practices on the land, certainly the land border, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland. So this is all very well tested around the world. And in fact, the EU itself has authorised operator programs with 26 nations already, which work on a similar basis. Of course, the EU trades with China, you know, on this basis, Japan, USA, and so on and so forth. So it covers off most of the, you know, most of the big trading nations, and there's no reason why this won't be applied to us. So all the mechanisms are there. We just have to do a little bit of bespoking to the specific British EU set of circumstances.
So Toby, I'm. You've clearly well read on the subject of business, the European Union, and very clear in your thoughts. But you in no way came from a highly privileged background and were thrown into sort of a deep education to learn about all of this. I'm interested in our guests and what drives them and motivates them. Can you explain a little bit about your own upbringing?
The upbringing. It was an awkward story to tell. I was brought up in a council house, social housing. I was on free school dinners. Was very much in the poor category. It was one parent family, brought up by my mother with my sister. And I just had a desire to move myself from, you know, poverty to prosperity as soon as and as quickly as I could. So that's the nature of where I've come from. But I'm in a vastly different situation than I was 40 years ago. You know, when I was a baby child. My passion is to move as many people from poverty to prosperity along that journey as quickly as we possibly can across the world. Poverty is not nice. You can have great love in poverty. Don't get me wrong. And I had a very loving environment in many respects, but you know, large aspects of it are not nice. So I've spent my non-working life interested in ways and means of how to move people up the prosperity ladder from the journey from poverty to prosperity, and free trade and some of the economic things that, you know, I've alluded to today are some of the greatest liberating factors for poor people. And that's one thing that really winds me up about the European Union. You know, it is ultimately a protectionist trading bloc. Whilst it's lovely and wonderful that inside it we're free to do trade and do whatever we want, and that is prosperous in itself, and better to a certain extent than how Europe was constituted before, but it is a massive wall and barrier to, you know, for example, African. Say if you're a cocoa grower in Ghana, trying to make ends meet, you never ever ever can invest in a processing facility to process your cocoa into high grade chocolate that you can sell to Europeans, because you've got a trade barrier erected against you. So instead, the Swiss will buy your cocoa beans and they'll do the processing and they'll sell to the European partners. So it's very discriminatory. and it's very anti-poor, I'm afraid to say. So whilst, you know, I hear what everyone says about their emotional sympathy and connectivity with you know, continental Europe and feeling all as one, it's a great affront to the poor people of the world who are discriminated against when they try and trade with it. That's an injustice, and I'm delighted that we are moving ourselves away from it.
Will we not be in the same position as Ghana, though, in that respect?
Well, we will be if vindictiveness and breaking various agreements that have been made around the world with the World Trade Organization, for example. Yes, we will be in that situation if that is the case. I don't think that needs to be the case, and I don't think the European people want that to be the case. So I have great hope that sense and reason will prevail on that one, Tim.
Can I ask, I'm not the most well-versed on economic issues, so I was wondering whether you could explain a bit to me in that analogy that you just mentioned how the EU's barriers would stand in the way of Ghana creating a facility to change cocoa into chocolate. How is the relation there? Could you explain that, please?
Well, there's a massive tariff for incoming agricultural products into the European Union. So, you know, you're taxed incredibly prohibitively. So you never really have the time. Whilst your stuff can move in, you pay the price, but you're being forced effectively to sell it at rock bottom prices. You never get enough money to save to invest in know, long-term in processing facilities, whereas the processing facilities in Europe are in effect protected because they've created this artificial barrier to entry. So that's the problem.
But in a free
trade environment, the case for free trade, by the way, is just in case you don't know, Jenny, it's pretty much, I mean, 95 or even 99% of all economists. It's one of the few things that all economists will actually say, yes, ticking the box, we all agree on. And if I just put that in very, very simple language, if you think of a doctor and if you think of a receptionist and you think of, you know, the doctor could more than likely do the work of the receptionist in absolute terms better than the receptionist, because the doctor, she may be more educated, or she will be more educated, more than likely, more competent in a whole variety of ways and a whole variety of different skills. But if the doctor, if she used her absolute advantage against the receptionist and did the receptionist's job, she'll do far less patient care. Yeah, far, far less patient care. So net good to society is diminished when you trade on your absolute advantage. So you trade on your comparative advantages, and that way the receptionist there doesn't have to compete with the doctor, because they're never ever going to compete with the doctor and win on the basis of being a receptionist. But being a receptionist and specializing in her skill base there allows massive productivity in the doctor's surgery in the receptionist area, and then allows the doctor to have massive productivity in her area of the surgery. Net benefit to society, much more. Yeah. So that means you trade to your comparative advantages, and what applies to the individual applies to the nations of the world as well. So you don't want barriers in the way, and you don't want people playing to their absolute advantages. So that's the case with free trade. And we need to make sure that that doesn't get in the that no political interests get in that way.
Okay, but is there not a case to be made for the fact that as you are so invested in sort of trying to raise up and support the poor to be able to have more money and take care of themselves, do you not think that free trade can also, through that amount of competition that is there, sort of incentivize companies to earn more and spend less and cut benefits and have workers be lesser paid with lesser benefits and then have them end up in a worse place because the company was trying to make more money on a competitive market?
Well, all those, I mean, this is often said, irrespective of free trade or anything, it's often said that that's a problem with the capitalist system. But, you know, funnily enough, those people who don't pay and reward those their members of staff properly usually ultimately end up going out of business because they don't attract the right labour long term. Yes, they exist in short term. Yes, they exist in isolation. Yes, there are people who abuse the system. But on the whole, these are very much in the minority. And the good thing about a competitive marketplace is usually these people get shut down within a generation because those models aren't sustainable. What's sustainable is if you reward people, you know, in accordance with their productivity, and if you provide them with a work environment where they want to genuinely, you know, perform to their best. Which means, you know, not a slave pit, but somewhere that's enjoyable to go to. This is overwhelmingly the case. But yes, you can find bad examples.
Toby, conservatives are generally accepted as the most pro-business party. All polls suggest that they are going to take the general election by storm. Are you happy with the way that Britain is going domestically, politically? I mean, there is a huge gap between the rich and the poor, and it's wider than it's ever been. So something doesn't seem to be gelling quite right.
Yes. Well, I mean, I can give you a binary answer that yes, I will support the Conservative Party, and I will be happy to see Theresa May's government get re-elected with a strong mandate to do what they need to do, certainly concerning Brexit. I think in her heart and soul, she's motivated by a richer and a deeper agenda on social reform than the last Tory Prime Minister. So I'm delighted by that. But you know, are there problems? Yes, Tim, there are massive problems. You know, we as a taxpayers, you know, you, me, Jen, were forced to bail out the banking system, the whole banking system, and instead of putting the bankers on minimum wage or on state benefits, they're still being paid their spectacular, almost mythical type salaries, and they've been kept in their plush houses, and with all the various accoutrements that are attached to that lifestyle. This is a disgrace. You know, it's a disgrace, and if you're a metal worker in Middlesbrough, whilst you may be seeing your wages go up nominally, you know, in terms of real terms, you're not getting anywhere. And you can't understand. You might not be able to articulate why this is the case, but you know that there's a certain type of person, particularly in London, and particularly in the city, who's living off the hog, and that's a disgrace. And there's no doubt about that. That is an absolute disgrace. That's crony capitalism, but it's worse. The bankers have captured, you know, part of the political process. And that has not been addressed yet. And people and politicians have encouraged them to seek to address that, because that's one of the chief reasons why people may not be able to articulate it like that. But why so many people voted for Brexit, because they feel totally alienated from a London class and elements of the London class that have captured the system. To the disadvantage of the masses, and that's why you've got this dichotomy between, you know, who's viewed to be seen to be the liberal elite, and who isn't. So yes, there's huge fractures in society, Tim, and are not being addressed, and still need to be addressed. And my heart, my soul pains to see that, and I won't, you know, stop advocating things that try and alleviate that.
I have a general sense with your view on the financial services sector that if London stopped becoming a financial capital of the world, you wouldn't be too disappointed.
Well, no, Tim, you misread me there. You know, I'm delighted that, you know, historically, London was one of the first modern financial trading centres. It's been one of the most innovative. And my word is my bond was, you know, a thing that existed there where these guys had open liability, open and ended liability, because they were viewed as fiduciaries, you know, for many years. You entrusted them with your money and your wealth, almost like, you know, when you go to a doctor, you trust them to give you good and sensible advice. Now that's all changed. And we need to have a close examination to some of those, you know, centuries old values that underscored the City of London, and go back to a bit of those. So I'm very pro the City of London in that respect, but I'm not pro people having it off at our expense. That's a disgrace. If I run a business badly, negatively, and I drive my business into the ground, you know, that's my fault, yeah? And I don't require you, Tim, or you, Jen, to bail me out, you know. An act of charity is an entirely different thing, but I have no right of compulsion to be bailed out for my you know, own mistakes, and they've had that writ large. And that's wrong, yeah? That needs to stop, and I don't think there's any... Realistically, though, I don't think there's any chance of the whole of London being anything other than the centre of the financial world, because so much activity is plugged in it. You just can't replace these things overnight.
Mm. Reading a little that you'd written before the podcast, one thing struck me as quite interesting was when you sold your business, Direct Seafoods, in 2010, for a time, having had that, made some money there, you sat with wealth managers and you saw the sort of zigzagging of your net asset performance, and you felt that you sort of didn't have control over what was going to happen with your money, with your wealth moving forward, and that wasn't a place you felt comfortable with anyway.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it was soul destroying, Tim. You know, when you've It's funny in society, and I fell for this line, you know, on my path from poverty to prosperity. You know, get out of it as quickly as you can, build something up, and, you know, sell it as quickly as you can. Have your, call it your liquidity event, sort of bizarre way of describing it, and turn your company into money or electronic digits, and then wow, you've kind of done it. That's it. But it's not it, you know. You live the next day and the day after the day after that, and you've got to think, well, what do I want to do with my life? And you know, there are lots of plush, very well educated, very well mannered, impeccably brought up bankers who will happily manage that money and that wealth for you. And don't get me wrong, I mean, loads of them will do a very, very good job of it, and. You know, if you're an orphan and a widow, it's probably the best thing for you, because you might not have the skills and competencies to do something, you know, more constructive or purposeful with it. But it is just looking at, you know, pieces of paper saying you're up this, you're down that, and you've got no idea why. You're invested in things that you think are prima facie good. Of course, you don't invest in anything you think is bad, but it doesn't give you any fulfillment. So, you know, that lasted for 2 years, and I remember saying to my wife, we were on a holiday in August of 2013, look, I'm going to go mad if I don't go back to doing something purposeful with this money. Then I started investing in private businesses in support of or alongside with other entrepreneurs. And, you know, really, I've no idea what my net worth is now, and I'm happy. You know, when I knew what my net worth is in terms of monetary digits, I was not happy. I know I'm now rich and wealthy, and, you know, I don't have a problem with putting a roof over my head or feeding my family. That's a wonderful position to be in. I'm blessed and I'm privileged. Yeah. And I'm going to do my best to make sure other people, wherever I can help them in the businesses that I'm involved in, you know, can have the same feeling of contentment and happiness. But it's definitely not all about just getting a load of monetary digits in your bank account. You've got to have purpose in terms of what you're doing. And I think these shows like Dragon's Den and all that kind of thing, they're just wrong. You know, I can't countenance that type of approach to moving yourself out from poverty to prosperity. You know, you need a bit more than just how that's positioned.
Mm. As we just touched on, you founded Direct Seafoods, and I appreciate this was a while ago, but I'm assuming that you still have quite a good knowledge of the fishing industry. So I'm wondering how you see this whole issue that's been coming up a lot recently about EU versus UK waters and where can and cannot be fished post-Brexit.
Yes. I wouldn't say I'm an expert. I keep an interest. Of course I do, you know, because I spent 22 years in that environment. But, you know, undoubtedly we voted to take our territorial waters back. That's what's implied by, you know, leaving the European Union. I mean, whenever I've been asked, I have suggested that we have some kind of grandfathering rights system for European boats that are operating in this water, vice versa with our boats operating in European Union waters, so we can be respectful towards each other's, you know, existing arrangements and just let them fizzle out, you know, over as the next generation comes through, but honour whoever's doing whatever they're doing now. But certainly we need to we take our territorial waters back. They're five times the size of the landmass of the United Kingdom, and are extremely extremely valuable. And, you know, at the start of my career, 1991 actually, so more than that, many years ago, I think the British fleet was about 40,000 boats, and I think now it's down to about 10,000 boats. And that's all to the other side of the equation. There have been efficiencies in boats, and boats have got larger, but largely the difference is made up by European boats in our waters. So we've been incredibly disadvantaged as a fishing community, and that's why you've seen places like Grimsby and Hull suffer terrible deprivation, places like Peterhead. Aberdeen's had the oil industry, which has counterbalanced it, but, you know, all along that coast and all along our south coast, where there have been great fishing industries that have been totally devastated. So, absolutely, I'm fully for taking our territorial waters back, but I think we can do it with some grace and some respect and do it amicably.
Toby, thanks ever so much for joining us today. You think you've articulated your position really well, and it's been an absolute pleasure to listen to you. Just very finally, when we leave the European Union, what do you see its future? And do you still see it existing in the same way in, say, a decade's time?
I don't think it can. And that's why I think it's good we're out. I mean, and I say that with a sorry heart. I mean, genuinely with a sorry heart. But the reasons why I don't think it will stay together is because there's a great polarization between the wealthy northern parts and the poor southern parts. And to a certain extent, it benefits, say, for example, Germany, because it has effectively a currency that's subsidized, really. It's a lower value currency than it would be if it's the Deutschmark. That helps them out, you know, tremendously. But then on the other side, they're having to be involved in bailouts all the time. You know, there's only so much the German taxpayer will put up with. So there are some inherent contradictions in there. And unless you're going, the United States worked because there was a commonality in culture. So, you know, the 13 states of the Union, the colonial states could form the nucleus of that of the United States of America. There's nothing like that with Europe. You know, each of those nations has a couple of thousand years of history in independence. So, you know, there's fault lines there that are going to be very difficult for them to overcome. And there's the economic fault lines as well. I don't think anyone in Europe should be worried, because if it does fall apart, you become globally, take a global outlook and become a free trading nation. Barriers come down, across the world that way, and that could be a good thing at the end of the day for the European people. In fact, I know it will be a good thing for the European people, but I think I'm in a clearly a minority in that way, Tim. I don't know. I think many people in Europe hold that view, but they may be forced down that line because of the inherent contradictions that I've just mentioned.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please feel free to subscribe to us and follow us on the usual social networks at Brexit Podcast and at brexitpodcast.com to stay up to date on all the best Brexit news and opinions. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Paul, and our theme song is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod.